Accession number 12317, and this is reel 3.
Commander Young, reel 3.
Well, in June, I got a signal appointing me to a new S-class submarine that was being built in the same dockyard where Saracen had been built. The name of this submarine was Storm. And I joined her before any crew had been appointed. The only officer who was there at all, any crew member that was there at all, was the engineer officer, who had been with the submarine for a month already. And he was a bit disconcerted to find his new captain was a two-striper RNVR, because he was RN. And I could see that he was very taken aback by this. You know, here was his beautiful submarine that he was now very familiar with, proud of, no doubt, was going to be in the command of a wavy navy chap who, you know, coming from civilian life. Anyway, he took me down to look at the boat and showed me what was going on, and in the end we got on very well indeed, and I didn't try to impress him with how much I knew. I would always tell him if something I didn't understand, I'd say, "Now come on, Chief, explain this to me exactly." And we worked well, very well on that basis. I mean, later on, if there was something wrong with one of the engines, I'd get him to tell me in detail what was wrong and how it would affect the operation of the submarine and so on and so forth. And we got on terribly well, and I was very fond of Bill Ray. Eventually we came to the point where the submarine was nearly ready, and members of the crew were starting to arrive. I had asked for two chaps from my training submarine, the first lieutenant and the navigating officer. And so they came, and Jeff Stewart was the first lieutenant, and Brian Mills was the navigator. And in due course, the submarine was ready to go, and I had the terrible, terrifying experience of taking the submarine out for its first run out into the Mersey. It's the first time it had been under its own steam. And I was terrified I was going to make a cock up of something or other. However, all went well. We went up half a mile up the Mersey, then turned around and came back in through the dockyard. And to my great relief, we came back alongside and all was well. Finally, we were told to take the submarine up to Dunoon in the Holy Loch in the Clyde for our working up period.
Now, if we could please go on to the start of your operations in command of the Storm. What was your first operation with it, please?
The first operation was to do a patrol off the Norwegian coast. Fairly high up towards the Arctic, I don't think we saw any enemy ships. It was very boring, uneventful patrol. However, it did give us the opportunity to work together, to get used to the submarine, and me to get used to the crew and my officers. And
this was in the autumn of 1943,
Yes, about November 43.
Then where did you go?
Then we went to Ceylon via the Suez Canal.
Was the journey out to the Far East uneventful?
No brushes with the enemy. I mean, by this time the Mediterranean was clear, and I think we had one aircraft came over and attacked us on the way through the Mediterranean. But it was nothing particular happened.
You were based at Trincomalee while you were in Ceylon?
In Ceylon, we were based on Trincomalee. Yes.
What was that base like?
It was a huge, enclosed, natural harbour. There was the submarine depot ship, Maidstone. There was an aircraft carrier in there. Jackie Broom was the skipper of that. Several other smaller ships, and of course, several submarines. First night we were in there, we'd had to take the engines down for some minor trouble that needed sorting out. And I suddenly called to the captain submarine's office and told that he wanted us to sail for the Malacca Straits the next day, because they'd had a signal saying that the Japanese fleet might be coming through, and he wanted to send all submarines to try and see what we could do about it. And I had to say that my engine needed another 24 hours, and reluctantly he gave me the 24 hours. So eventually we set off, and so there we were on our first patrol in very shallow, enclosed waters in the Malacca Straits.
What was it like operating in Far Eastern waters as compared with the European ones?
Well, one of the differences was that the Japs had very little in the way of aircraft and very little in the way of anti-submarine ships. So that one never knew what was going to come along. The disadvantage, a great disadvantage, was that the waters were very shallow, and if you got attacked, you didn't have very far to go down to get away. So that there's always this great fear of running aground or hitting the bottom or just being seen in the very clear water.
What were physical conditions like in view of the heat and humidity?
Well, the heat was a great bother. Although our first patrol was in February 1944, it was already it was still extremely hot. Inside the submarine, especially during an attack, most people just have a towel around their middle, no clothes on at all. I remember one occasion I was doing an attack and I suddenly became terribly dizzy and confused, and I called for a glass of salty water, and within seconds, having knocked back this glass of salty water, I was absolutely all right. We were suffering, we suffered very much from desalination because of the perspiration. And, well, it just was very hot.
What did you feel about your prospects should you be caught by the Japanese?
Well, I think we felt that whereas if you'd been captured by the Germans, you'd be treated like a prisoner with, you know, due respect for the international laws of warfare. One didn't have this feeling about the Japanese at all. And yes, one had a nasty feeling that if you got caught by the Japanese, life would be extremely unpleasant.
Were you warned about this by the authorities at Trincomalee, or what, did they just leave you to put two and two together?
I think everybody knew, and I don't think you needed any instruction about it. One just knew this about the Japanese. In fact, shortly before we got out there, a Japanese submarine had sunk some merchant ship somewhere in the Indian Ocean, and it had all the crew up on the deck of the submarine and just hacked them to pieces. Whether this was a propaganda story or not, but it was generally reckoned to be true. In fact, they knew the number of this submarine, and later on I had the misfortune of having this submarine coming through my area, starting an attack on it, and in the middle of the attack it suddenly turned away and vanished, and it was believed to be that particular submarine which we were all out to get.
What kind of successes did you have on patrol in the islands of Southeast Asia?
Well, mostly the targets that came along were tended to be smallish ships, because the Japs were using a lot of local shipping for carrying things like iron ore, and I forget what else, but basically iron ore in ships which are so small that they were A, difficult to hit with a torpedo because they're so shallow, and B, not worth the cost of a torpedo. So that most of my clashes with the enemy were on the surface by gunfire. I did sink one merchant ship in the Malacca Straits by torpedo. And then I had as a result of that attack, I got hunted quite a long time, which gave us a lot of trouble because we were unable to surface to charge the batteries one whole night. Fortunately, we managed to slip away and were able to put in a good charge the next night.
How long would your batteries last for on the storm?
Depending on what you used the batteries for. If you did a lot of attacking, then not very long. But if you're just trickling along, you know, periscope watch, so on and so forth, I suppose you could go 30 hours, say a day and a half.
How much danger was there on attacking on the surface in Southeast Asia? Would the quarry have guns with which they could reply?
Yes, and they did. I mean, the danger there always was that an unlucky hit might penetrate your pressure hull, and then you'd be unable to dive. And you'd be a sort of sitting target for... If the Japs discovered they had a submarine, you had a submarine on the surface, unable to dive, they'd soon send any number of airplanes out to get you.
Did you ever come across any Japanese warships?
Small ones, yes.
Destroyers,
yes. Particularly later on when we moved to Australia, an operator from there, Western Australia, to get to our petroliers, we had to go something like 2,000 miles and on the way go through the Lombok Strait, which is a very narrow strait. And practically every time you went through there, you met an enemy destroyer. And it was always a rather nervous time. We got spotted by one night who chased us. And we had to go down and gradually evade him.
What was the morale of the crew like?
Not my crew? Splendid. I mean, I never had any complaint about my crew at all. We were very lucky. We were a very happy ship. And I had a splendid coxswain who had, was a big, sort of burly chap who commanded great respect in the crew. And he was an absolutely splendid fellow. He had better eye, I reckon that I had very good eyesight, especially night vision. But he was even better than me, and he would spot something at night on the horizon before I did. And I never known anybody who was so good at night vision as he was.
When you were talking about Europe, you mentioned that job that you had once with the French agent. Did you have any jobs in Southeast Asia with dropping off of agents or collecting them?
I had a job on one patrol of dropping an agent, waiting for him, and then picking him up again a few nights later. And this nearly led to a disastrous problem, because the night we went to pick him up, things didn't seem that he was supposed to flash a light from the place where we'd dropped him, and at a particular time. And to start with, the light didn't come when we expected it. It came half an hour later, but exactly half an hour later. And I think probably this was due to the we discovered afterwards that he had been caught by the Japs, and they were holding him there, hoping to entice us, you know, to trap us into going close in. But when we went to pick him up, first of all, the light didn't come on until precisely half an hour later. And I think probably it was due to some local zone time that they were working on. But it was odd that it was exactly half an hour late. And it wasn't quite in the right place. Anyway, the boat crew, two army chaps, they went in the canoe. I had to make them go in the end, because, you know, I say, look, unless you go now, I'm going to call off this whole operation. Eventually he went in, and suddenly we realised that he turned around and was coming back towards us, and guns opened up on us. There was a big gun, a sort of 5-inch or 6-inch or something. It was on a kind of promontory high up, was firing straight over our heads, and there were machine guns firing in from all directions, and it got quite exciting. So we had to sort of wait for this canoe to get back to us with a hatch open waiting to let them in down there. And eventually they made it. I decided in my own mind that providing that big gun didn't actually get our range, because he was sort of going over and then going short, and I'd wait. Fortunately, they got to us eventually, and then we went out to see whether everybody's still firing us.
This was one of the islands of the Dutch East Indies, was it?
It was Sumatra. It was called
How did you,
Sabang, I think it was
as a submariner, how did you like having to do that kind of work with agents as compared with attacking enemy shipping?
Not at all, because during the whole of that period of the operation, we couldn't attack any enemy shipping, so as not to draw attention to the area. So we felt it was a terrible waste of our time, and not the sort of job that we ought to be doing.
These are shark-infested waters in Southeast Asia. Did that cause you any apprehension? Or was it something that never crossed your mind?
Never crossed our mind. I mean, the things that never really cross your mind is being captured and, you know, being sunk, because you just decide you're not going to be in that position.
Just wishful thinking?
No, determination.
Could I ask you about a film which was shown on television a few years back, which was a German film about the German U-boat during the war?
Das Boot.
Yes, it was called Das Boot. Mm. I don't know if you saw that,
yes,
that
I did.
Series.
Yeah.
Did you feel that that depicted life in a submarine in the war accurately, or was the German experience too different from yours to ring a bell?
Well, I felt that the German experience was extremely different. For one thing, they were up against very strong anti-submarine warfare. I mean, the British destroyers and corvettes in the War of the Atlantic gradually learned how to do it, and they really, in the end, completely mastered the U-boat. And I would not like to have been in the shoes of any German submariner going out into the Atlantic in the second half of the Atlantic War.
But were the discomforts on board the ship similar?
Yes, but what appalled me was the general state of morale. I mean, they seemed to get in the most terrible panics, and the atmosphere in the submarine was so different from, I don't know whether ours was typical of a British submarine, but the things that people did and said just would not have happened in our submarine.
Can you give an example?
No, I can't remember the details.
You mean it was more disciplined and orderly in your submarine?
Yes, I'd say so. But, I mean, morale was very high and very good. But, as I say, I'm comparing it with submarines that had to go out and with the likelihood that they were going to be sunk. It was less than a 50-50 chance of coming back for the German submariners in the second part of the war. I was appalled by the state of morale depicted in that film.
When the war came to an end, how relieved were you that the submarine warfare for you was at an end? Did it come as a great relief or not?
Well, we finished our commission and came back to England before the end of the Japanese war. No, sorry, before the end of the... before VE Day. And VE Day came fairly soon afterwards, and I was given a staff job, and most of my time on that staff job was unwinding the whole operation, and, as it were, putting submarines into mothballs, and nothing to do, and the whole atmosphere changed. So it took all the sparkle and fun out of the whole thing. And I was very glad when the war did end, and I was able to leave and go back to my civilian job.
What did the sparkle and fun consist of, though?
Well, the feeling that you were preparing for action, and the action was all over, and you know, what was it all about anymore? It became a kind of dull routine administration job.
So you mean operations were exciting for you rather than a trial?
Well, they were stimulating. Oh, yes. You know, when you've been trained to go out and attack the enemy and suddenly it's all over, it's a tremendous sort of deflationary feeling, atmosphere. Although you're glad it's all over, it must have been worse for the regular Navy chaps, because this was their profession. For me, it was all over, but at the same time, I was going to get married and I was going back to my civilian job.